Hello, everybody, and welcome back to yet another Science Studio program. This is Keith Pannell, and today we're going to be talking to someone who had a career in science, maybe still has a little career, actually doing research in science, but has risen to the rank of being a director of one of the National Institutes of Health Institutes, in particular the NIGMS, which is the National Institute of General Medical Science. His name is John Lorsch, and he's at the other end of the phone. And John, welcome.
Thank you very much, Keith.
It's a pleasure to talk to you. But before we get on to the position that you hold and the budget that you oversee and how did you get there, let's talk about John as a very young boy. Well, how did you become enamored with the idea of doing science for a career or even doing it as for fun?
Well, actually, Keith, it goes back to when I was 4 years old and a teacher came into our classroom and showed the class a cow heart. And I have a vivid memory, it's one of my earliest memories, of him holding up this cow heart, and I was absolutely mesmerized by the structure with all of its flaps and chambers. And actually, really, at that moment, I think I decided I wanted to be a scientist. And that was pretty much my determination for the rest of my childhood and into my actual career.
So, I mean, you didn't look at the cow heart and think nice things about the cow. It was purely the heart.
It was the heart. And, you know, while the other students were screaming and, yes. You know, maybe retching, I was just enraptured by this thing.
Well, I sound like the other students. I remember I wasn't four. I was about eight when one of my teachers came in with a bull's eye and then proceeded to cut into it. So vitreous humor spraying everywhere. And I didn't think cogently at the time, but that steered me away from biology, I must say that. Well, anyway, so that was that, and your parents were very happy when you showed this interest.
Well, they were. In fact, my mother was very helpful in this regard, and she let me do all kinds of experiments in the kitchen. And I certainly learned very early on the reaction between baking soda and vinegar producing carbon dioxide and PV equals NRT, and how I could actually make things blow up if I put vinegar and baking soda together in a closed container.
Well, this is wonderful.
Yeah, I made lots of rockets and various things that caused quite a mess, I think. But my mother was very patient. And actually, I got a number of chemistry sets, I remember, as a kid. And
okay, so your parents really were supportive.
Yeah.
Did they have any interest themselves in science?
No, neither one. My father is actually a professor of business administration, mm-hmm. and my mother had a career in communications for universities, so neither one was a scientist.
Where did you go to school? Just run us very quickly through your educational process.
Well, so I went to a high school in Boston called the Commonwealth School, which is a very small school, but very devoted to intellectual training. And that was really one of my early formative experiences. From there, I went to Swarthmore College in Pennsylvania and majored in chemistry, minored in biology. And from there, I went to Harvard, where I got my PhD in biochemistry. And after that, I did a postdoctoral fellowship at Stanford, also in biochemistry. And from there, I got a faculty position at Johns Hopkins Medical School.
So that's for the folks out there, that's a pretty good pedigree. And I didn't realize until you just said it that you actually started out in chemistry and biochemistry.
Exactly.
So this makes it all the more pertinent to this program. I'm a chemist, as you well know. So this is very nice. Now tell me, when you were in the high school, in the Commonwealth School, were you involved in science fair projects?
You know, that wasn't really a thing when I was in high school that we did, but I was given a lot of leeway at the school to do my own sorts of experiments. And we had what was called Project Week and Project Month for seniors, where you had to develop your own project of some kind and execute it either during the week or when you're a senior during the month. And I did a number of science projects with some help from the chemistry teacher, a man named Mr. Robinson, who let me do all kinds of things, including growing yeast and allowing it to ferment to make, of course, ethanol, and then making a still to actually distill off the ethanol to, you know, show those important chemical principles, which I'm sure was illegal. But
oh, yeah. Did you actually taste it just to make sure that, you know, the proof of the pudding is in the eating or the drinking?
So a true story is that as I was running this still, okay, in the chemistry room, the headmaster of the school, a man named Mr. Chatfield, came in. And he asked me what I was doing. And, of course, I was somewhat apprehensive about, you know, telling him exactly what was happening, but I did confess exactly what I was doing. And he thought about it for a minute, for very quietly, and then he said, And he put his finger under the, you know, what was coming out of the still, and then put it in his mouth.
All right.
And he thought about it for another minute. He said, "That's pretty good. I think you've done a good job." And then he walked out. So.
Oh, that's very nice. Now, I was briefly looking up your vita, and it seems to me that when you were in Swarthmore, you, in fact, did get involved in undergraduate research very early on, and I think resulting in a paper.
That's right. And the fascinating thing about that paper is that it was only published a few years ago, I think almost 20 years or so after I did the research. So that's an important lesson to all the listeners that I guess perseverance really does pay off eventually.
Well, that wasn't a factor of reproducibility, I hope.
No, it wasn't. It was just the length of time it took for the work to be finally, you know, accomplished. We were looking at bacteria that were resistant to mercury poisoning and trying to understand, purify the enzyme that was responsible for reducing the mercury that gave them this resistance. And I purified the enzyme, but then it took another, again, 20 years, I guess, for other students to actually determine its sequence and clone it and understand the evolutionary relationship of this particular enzyme to other mercury resistance enzymes.
Now, that's actually very interesting because it cries out to the question of how do you continue to fund people that are doing good work, but it takes so long because of resources. When you finally got to your own position, Johns Hopkins, what area did you choose to investigate as a young faculty member?
So I was studying protein synthesis, so how proteins get made in a cell, and we were using yeast, again, I guess going back to yeast, as a model system. And what we actually did was to purify all the various components, the proteins, the ribosome, which is the machine inside of a cell that makes proteins, the messenger RNA, that's the template that gets read to make the corresponding proteins. We purified all those things separately, and then we could put them back together in a test tube and get protein synthesis to actually take place outside of the cell using purified components in a test tube, which, if you think about it, is an amazing thing. And then we use that, what's called a reconstituted system, to study the molecular mechanics, the actual mechanisms through which this protein synthesis takes place in a cell.
And you were successful at this. I mean, you got many grants, many papers, I noticed.
That's right.
But then something happened on the way to...
On the way to the forum.
On the
right?
way to somewhere, yes. You've now got this position, an incredibly important position, as the director of NIGMS. What were your thought processes about changing a career? Before we get on to what NIGMS is and does, how did you begin to formulate the idea that maybe there was something beyond just basic research for you and your career?
Yeah, it's a great question. So it actually happened because of teaching and education. And when I got to Johns Hopkins, I was really mostly focused on doing research. I thought that's what I was going to spend almost all my time, if not all my time, doing. But what happened was, right as soon as I got there, I was actually thrown into the deep end of the teaching pool. And I was assigned to direct a small discussion group for the medical students at Johns Hopkins about biochemistry in their biochemistry class. And rather than hating this, which I thought in advance maybe I was going to, I found out that I loved it, and I really enjoyed teaching these kids. They were great. I understood that if you worked hard on their behalf, they really responded very well and learned the material and seemed to enjoy it. And that got me more and more involved in teaching, and eventually I took over the whole course. That led to me becoming the director, eventually, of the first-year medical curriculum at Hopkins. And from there, I kind of took on additional leadership and administrative roles. And what I discovered was that in addition to loving science and loving, now I discovered teaching, I also found that I really enjoyed leadership and administration because it was a way to have a bigger impact, hopefully positive impact, on science and education. And at some point along the way, I concluded that eventually I was going to want to transfer some of my career into these kinds of leadership and administrative roles.
And on a bigger stage.
Exactly.
Right. Well, let's just put you on the spot. Can you think back to your period in Hopkins and say, hey, this is where I made a big difference? Not the scientific papers, but in your role as an administrator at that level, what can you look back on and say, this was really a good departure, something that wasn't going on before, but when I left, it was there, and I was responsible?
So there are a number of things, many having to do with, again, education and the curriculum. We reformed the entire curriculum, the medical curriculum at Hopkins, and I was involved in that. And then in the course that was the basic biomedical sciences course, which I took over leading, we made a lot of different changes to how the teaching was done, made it much more interactive, brought on, for instance, audience response systems so that we could ask questions of the students, and we disseminated that throughout the entire first-year curriculum. So I think really making the educational process much more active and engaging is something that I was able to have a significant impact on.
So not just the usual, the professor gets up there and talks.
And, exactly.
The students sit there and
passively
take notes or don't take notes.
Exactly. And so I think we tried to make it much more engaging, interactive, have the students do some of the teaching of their peers, both in small groups and also in the larger lecture hall. And then I've tried to move that also into teaching the graduate students, the students who are going to go on into scientific research. So, I think that's an area that we really did have a pretty significant impact.
And if you look at modern-day education in universities, these ideas are cropping up all over the place. The whole concept of peer-led learning and things of that nature. But you've got to change the way that you view the subject matter. I mean, at least I think you do, in the sense that your students have to come, I think, a little better prepared to the class for that to work really well. You say, well, we're going to cover, chapter 6, in the next 2 weeks. You go away and make sure you've really got to grips with chapter 6 so that when you go in there with this more interactive form of teaching, I think it's more effective.
That's right. I agree. And, the goal there is for them to use the material rather than to try to absorb it while they're in the classroom.
Excellent.
And I think this focus on teaching skills more than cramming facts into people's head is something that I've been pushing both when I was at Johns Hopkins and now that I'm here at the NIH.
And certainly when everybody's got their little intelligent phone and they look up things, Google is out there, Google Scholar is there. Knowing facts in your head is no longer really quite so necessary.
I think that's right. But knowing how to use them and make the best of them is what's critical.
Absolutely.
Right?
You're listening to Science Studio. My name is Keith Pannell. Our guest today is John Lorsch, who is the director of NIGMS, the National Institutes of General Medical Sciences. We'll be back in one moment.
Welcome to Medical Discovery News. I'm Dr. David Neisel.
And I'm Dr. Norbert Herzog. Up to 80% of dementia cases are Alzheimer's, and yet today's treatments have only short-term results that peter out after just a year.
A new drug, though, is showing great promise. It sharply reduced cognitive decline for people with early dementia in a small clinical trial.
The new drug, aducanumab, targets beta-amyloid protein, which builds up in the brains of Alzheimer's patients, damaging neurons. The drug triggers an immune response and helps get rid of this protein.
166 people in early stages of dementia and with protein plaques in their brains enrolled in the study. They were randomly given the drug or a placebo.
The researchers had expected to see a 20 to 30% reduction in cognitive decline, but much to their surprise, patients given high doses of the drug experienced a 70% reduction in mental impairment.
One major side effect was a localized swelling of the brain, which occurred in half the patients genetically predisposed to Alzheimer's, but just 17% in those without the genetic variant.
Fortunately, the swelling did not cause symptoms, so it's possible by changing the drug's dose, the swelling can be controlled. Also, with new imaging that can determine plaque accumulation, people with the potential to develop dementia can be identified earlier and receive treatment.
Though the results are encouraging, other drugs that initially showed encouraging results did poorly in large clinical trials. Everyone's hoping that this drug will be different. Alzheimer's may triple by 2050 unless we find a breakthrough to significantly delay its onset or develop a cure.
We are Drs. David Niesel and Norbert Herzog at the University of Texas Medical Branch and the Frank H. Netter School of Medicine at Quinnipiac University, where biomedical discoveries shape the future of medicine. For much more and our disclaimer, go to medicaldiscoverynews.com.
Welcome back to Science Studio, Keith Pannell, talking with John Lorsch, who is the director of NIGMS, National Institutes of General Medical Sciences in Washington, D.C., and we were talking about his background and the cow's heart and changing the teaching paradigms. Now we'll get on to NIGMS. So, John, start out by just telling the audience as briefly as you think it's appropriate, what does NIGMS do?
So we are a funding agency. We provide funding for biomedical research around the country. The budget is about $2.4 billion. Almost all of that goes to support researchers, scientists, at universities, medical schools, and other research institutes across the U.S. in all 50 states. And so we have to make the decisions on which scientists to fund, how much funding each one needs, and
Opposed to requests.
That's right. There are a lot more requests for funds than we were able to fund, so much of our work is deciding how can we get the most science and the best science for the taxpayers' investments.
So now, but this covers a very large area, all the way from pharmacology to what we call bioinformatics, using mathematical models to sort of analyze big data. And so what committee is there? What group assigns relative importance to these different sections of biomedical science?
That's a great question. So there's actually several levels of review, and it's peer review. So the scientists themselves are reviewing one another's proposals. So a scientist sends in a proposal and says, I would like to work on this scientific question. Here's how I'm going to approach it. And then a panel of experts will take these proposals and review them and give them scores based on their perceived relative merit. So that's the first level of peer review. What happens then is it comes to the institute. The institute's program staff, who are themselves scientists, look at these, and they will make some preliminary judgments based on the scores and the written critiques. And then we have what's called an advisory council, which again is made up of experts, scientific experts, who will look at all of the critiques that came from the first panel and make sure that that process was fair and that there were no anomalies or biases that they can detect in the system. And then they make recommendations to the program staff for funding based on their assessments.
Yeah, but I think what I was more getting at is, we're computational biology compared to pharmacology. I mean, the breakdown of your 2.4 million, mm-hmm. This is where presumably people like yourself, the directors and a close group of you, make these decisions. Like, we think that at the moment pharmacology is really important because we're running out of drugs because of various drug-resistant diseases. Or how does that work?
So that's absolutely right. One of my jobs and the jobs of my senior staff is to make determinations on how we should distribute the funds within the portfolio, which, as you quite correctly point out, is quite broad in terms of supporting basic science in different areas. And the determination is complex. It depends on scientific opportunities, where we think we can get the biggest chances for important advances. We also want to have, and this is very important, a broad and distributed portfolio. We don't want to concentrate the funds in any particular area because science is inherently an unpredictable process. Breakthroughs come from unexpected places most of the time, and so having a broad and distributed investment portfolio tends to be the best way to get these advances to take place.
And one of the areas that I do know that you're responsible for is what we might call training the workforce.
Exactly.
And that is something that, well, I know a little bit about, and I'd like to hear from your end of the system. Where do you see the big challenges in the immediate future?
So, again, as you said, we are also a big supporter of training in science from the undergraduate level all the way through faculty development. And I think some of the things we were talking about before in terms of making sure that skills are being developed during the training and education process really are something that we're putting a lot of emphasis on, and getting more innovative methods for training the next generation of scientists, because they're going to have to work in very quantitative ways, in very interdisciplinary ways, and those required skills are going to need, I think, new approaches to education.
And so how do you go about, I mean, if you think of the manpower, I mean, classically, the University of Texas El Paso, where we are doing these programs, is a traditionally Hispanic intensive institution. I think 80% of our student body is Hispanic. And that doesn't translate into the workforce in science. I mean, they're underrepresented just as African Americans, et cetera. Is this a major concern for NIH?
Absolutely. And I think this actually goes to what I was saying a moment ago about having a broad and diverse portfolio. So we think about the need for diversity across all dimensions, from the kinds of scientific areas that are being studied, which is what I was talking about before, to the regions and institutions in which the work's being done, to the backgrounds of the individuals, the scientists doing the work. And that's because diversity, it's been shown in a variety of contexts, really builds strength. So having a more diverse scientific workforce will actually improve the kind of science that gets done, because people from diverse backgrounds bring different ideas, they bring different questions they want to study, and they bring different ways of approaching those studies. And so we have a number of programs whose focus is to build diversity within the scientific workforce.
And not just of subject matter, but the personnel, which
is... Exactly. The backgrounds of the people really do matter, right? Yeah. It matters where you were brought up. That will change the kinds of questions you're interested in studying. It may change the approaches you take to studying those questions, and that strengthens the scientific process.
Let's talk about that in a sense, because you touched on the background of the people, where they live. And there are some segments of society, well, there are lots of them, where science just doesn't come on the front burner, right? Where science is something somebody else does, but every now and again, there's a little scandal. Something has gone wrong. Mm-hmm. There's irreproducibility of results. And, you know, we both know about this article in Science, I think it was on Nature, you know, about 2 years ago, saying that something like 60, 65, 70% of a certain type of research in translational medicine for oncology were irreproducible. Is this a concern of you in NIGMS and NIH in general? And if so, how do you approach trying to think about this?
Well, this has been a very big concern for us. You're absolutely right. There's been a lot of press attention to it. The numbers that have been put out there for the amount of science that is irreproducible range from, say, 10 to 20% all the way up to 85%. And what's really important to recognize is that regardless of whether it's the 10% or the 85%, we can always do things better, and it should be our goal to do things better. And so we've been focusing both NIH-wide, and that was led by Francis Collins and Larry Tabak, who's the principal deputy director of NIH, and also at NIGMS specifically, on initiatives that we think can improve the way science is conducted to increase both the reproducibility of the work and also the strength of the conclusions themselves, to get better conclusions from the science that's done.
I mean, well, one of the things about reproducibility that as a chemist, now trained as a chemist, as I now know, that you know and I know, is that quite often there are very trace materials that cause reactions to proceed or not. I mean, when we know what we're doing, we call them catalysts. When we don't know what we're doing, they're impurities. And in the biological system, I would think that could be even a bigger picture, right? I mean, biochemistry, molecular biology, so complicated that very small amounts of material can perhaps cause this lack of reproducibility. And so some standardization of materials would seem to be a useful idea.
Absolutely. And you bring up several important points there. One is that biology is extremely complicated, and we don't understand it even remotely as well as we would like to. And so just because a result is not reproducible from one lab to another doesn't mean that it's wrong. It may mean that there is very interesting nuances that are happening, just as you suggest, that if we understood them, would tell us something important about how biology works. And so I think that's a very important point to recognize. In terms of the standardization issue you brought up, which is also a very important point, there are many different areas that would be helped considerably by having standards of various kinds. Just one example that we've actually been working on at NIGMS is in the area of tissue culture or cell culture, where mammalian or other animal cells are grown in flasks, basically in tissue culture flasks, to do experiments on using them as model systems. And what's been found over the years is that it turns out that many cell types that an investigator in a lab thinks are, say, a kidney cell type, may turn out not to be that cell type. They've been misidentified. And that, as you can imagine, if you think you're working on kidney cells and it turns out you're working on skin cells, that could really skew the conclusions of your results and the apparent reproducibility. And so having standards for how we can
identify
those cells and make sure that from one experiment to the next and one lab to the next, if you think you're working on kidney cells, you in fact are working on not just kidney cells, but the same kidney cells, is something that we really are pushing to improve in the system.
I've been to a few meetings recently talking about the general malaise, or not malaise, the difficulty young people have getting funding. Older professors like myself, we seem to be able to, we know what we're doing a little better, we know how to write the proposals a little better, and we need to mentor the young ones. But do you think there's coming to a point where we say in North America, look, you've had a career, you're 65, 67, you name the date, I think it's time that we simply stop your funding, not because you're not doing anything good, but for the best, you know, future of scientific research, we've got to do something like that. They do it in foreign countries.
Yeah, and I think it's a complicated question, but certainly it's an important one for the workforce to think about. How do we ensure there is enough young talent coming into the system when certainly history says that many of the most creative and important ideas and discoveries are made by people in the early parts of their career? On the other hand, I don't think we want to just arbitrarily end the careers of someone who's still very productive. It turns out we have data now, an increasingly big body of data, that the productivity and the scientific impact of a researcher in the life sciences doesn't actually scale proportionally with the amount of funding they have over a fairly modest threshold,
right,
on average. And so if you think about my job as an investor of the taxpayer money, which is ultimately what I do, to get the best return for the taxpayer's dollar, we want to have, again, a broad and distributed portfolio where there are many investigators, maybe somewhat more modestly funded,
yes,
than currently.
Hey, look, we've got to finish. Yeah. But that was spoken like a really perfect administrator. I will say, John, that just sounds absolutely perfect. John Lorsch, who is the director of NIGMS, National Institutes of General Medical Sciences in Washington, D.C. I'd like to thank you. And, of course, I have to thank Norma Martinez for, in the end, putting this together so that the listener out there now can hear it. And so thank you very much. And we'll be back next week with another Science Studio.